To be drunk ever thereafter for staying awake. So the plant of Buddhism, tea is the Buddhist drink, just like wine is the Christian drink, coffee is the Islamic drink, and milk the Hindu drink. Every religion has its drink. So then around this kind of appreciation, born of stillness, and the delight in seeing how nature takes its course, came the entire cult of Zen art with its special kind of primitivity, its special ceramics, its special calligraphic styles, and its special gardens, which are the controlled accident. Now you see, this is a water jar. They like to leave the bottom unglazed. You can really see that it's clay that way. But look, you see how the glaze has been allowed to run. It's what we would call not neat at all. And you watch somebody make one of these. And I have watched a man just pick up the plate, and as he applies the design of the glaze, he just goes whoosh with a brush and lets it drop on, and it's done. There's another man who glazes by wood smoke, and in his kiln he may put about 1,100 pieces, and he wraps them in straw. And wherever the straw touches, it leaves a splash of orange color against a purple background. Now, you see, the straw arranges itself according to the nature of straw. It doesn't follow strict human direction. And the fascination is when they open up that kiln and bring the things out, they look eagerly to see, what has the straw done? So, this principle of letting glaze run to see what will happen is Wu Wei. This is non-interference. This is Mu Xin also. No purpose, or it can also be translated, no specific intent. And now, of course, you see, sometimes this doesn't work. And the master picks it up and says, that's not very interesting, and rejects it. What are the canons of taste which decide whether he will accept one of these accidents or reject it? Because here an additional principle of control enters. See, say in the practice of calligraphy, a man may sit down with a huge pile of paper in front of him and do piece after piece after piece, and if it isn't just right, he throws it away. So he eventually makes a selection that comes out. There's a famous story of a Zen master who was doing calligraphy, and he had a very smart monk standing beside him who was his assistant. And the monk said, to each one as he did it, you can do better than that. Oh, no, no, come now, you know much better than that. This master got more and more furious, but the monk had to go out to the benjo, to the toilet for the moment. And he thought, quick, while he's away, he did it. And the monk came back and looked and he said, a masterpiece. So there's this element of selection, you see. Now, what determines this? How do you know? Or another example of this, there was a tea caddy, porcelain tea caddy, not porcelain, but clay. And when Senno Rikyu was having tea ceremony, he saw this tea caddy and made no comment on it. And the owner was so disappointed that he smashed it. But one of his friends picked the broken pieces out of the trash can and took them to a mender. And he said, look, mend this with gold. And he put, therefore, gold cement and put this caddy back together, and so it had all over its surface spidery lines of gold. And when Rikiu saw that, he was just enchanted, and it became one of the most valuable tea caddies in the Japanese collections. Spidery lines of gold following just the apparently chance marks of a smash. There was a competition at the Art Institute in the University of Chicago in which it was a sculpture class, and the competition was that each student was given a cubic foot of plaster of Paris. And they said, now do something with it. Well, the prize was won by a woman who looked at this cube and said, it has no character, it doesn't want to be anything. So she flung it on the floor and smashed it all up. I mean, she made dents in it and banged off the corners and put cracks in it and things. Then she looked at it again. She said, ah, now I know what it wants to be. And so she followed the grain in it, as it were, made by all these cracks, and produced this marvelous piece of sculpture. You have in this area a very ingenious sculptor by the name of Donald Hoard, who is a master at following the grain in wood and actually making the grain. The grain seems to suggest to him the muscles and the flow of the kind of body that he's making. Well, that's the thing. So, when a master decides whether the accident came off, what he wants is this. He wants the thing to be the perfect harmony of man and nature, of order and randomness. Now, this is a curious thing in the human mind. When we play games, we get most fascination out of those games which satisfactorily combine skill and chance. Games like bridge, poker, have a sort of admirable combination of these two elements. And we can go on playing those games again and again and again, because you don't feel completely at the mercy of chance, as you do with dice, unless you cheat. And you don't feel completely at the mercy of skill, as you do with chess, or especially with a game like three-dimensional chess. So there's a sort of optimum middle where order and randomness go together. Well, that's what this man is looking for. He's looking for the optimal combination. You see, things that are artwork like Persian miniatures or the jewelry of Cellini and Chinese porcelain is too much skill, too much order. It's like those houses you go into where you daren't put an ash in the tray because everything is so clean and everything is so tidy, you daren't touch it. One prefers a house, you see, that looks a little lived in, that is more genial, more comfortable, somehow invites you to sit down and even put your feet on the table. Whereas on the other extreme, some kind of pad where everything is covered in dirt and filthy clothes are thrown in the corner and, you know, people are all paint all over them and so on. That's the other extreme. We don't want that. But that's that curious thing in the middle. Now, the most difficult thing is to hold to the middle. It's like walking a tightrope. And that's why the path of Buddhism is called the razor's edge. Because you see what happened. When all this kind of work in the course of history became fashionable, people began to affect these styles. For example, when Sesshu, the great master ink painter, worked, he would sometimes take a handful of straw and paint with that instead of a brush in order to get the sort of rough effect that he wanted. But later on there came people who could take an ordinary paintbrush and so exactly ink that brush that it would give precisely the messy effect that they had in mind. They would also be able to ink a brush in such a way, and this is terribly decadent, They could dab grapes on a vine and have dark ink where the shadow was supposed to be, and no ink at all where the highlight was supposed to be. That's when they started getting mixed up with Western ideas about shadows and perspective. They didn't have that earlier. But they were so skilled in the handling of ink that they would do this sort of thing, and they would imitate, you see, all the so-called rough natural effects of the great Zen artists. And so today in Japan, a younger generation of artists has decided it's time to break all that up. If we imagine, for example, haiku parties, the writing of haiku poetry. Basho, who was the great 17th century master of haiku, said, get a 3-foot child to write haiku, because they are the sort of direct, guileless things that children would say. But now there are magazines devoted to haiku poetry, where in every issue there will be 10,000 haikus written by people all over the country, and they get so stilted and so affected that one wished one had never heard of haiku. The same thing is starting over here. And you should see the entries we get in these haiku competitions that Japan Airlines and other people sponsor. But it all, after a while, becomes dated, stilted, and so somewhere again, the new thing has to break out, which is always coming up. But there's no formula, you see, for fixing it so that you can do it again and again and again, because the moment you start doing it again and again and again, it isn't it anymore. The real thing has escaped. Do you remember? Some time ago, there was a fashion for having wrought iron fish, just the outline of a fish. Some artist originally, you know, put this fish together and it looked great. But then you suddenly found them in every gift shop and dime store, and they looked perfectly terrible. So this is the mysterious thing. Well, not only in the arts, but in lifestyles, in everything, when you start saying, what is the technique for getting this thing? And people say, well, this is it. It's gone. Same in education. Same in music. The moment you start teaching something, what question are you asking? How could we, is there some method whereby in our schools we could produce from the music department every graduation ceremony 3 musicians of the stature of Bach or Mozart? Now, if we knew how to do that, that knowledge would prevent us from being surprised by the work of these people, because we would know how it's done. And when you know how something is done, it doesn't surprise you. That's why there's a Zen poem which says, if you ask where the flowers come from, even the god of spring doesn't know. Certainly the god of spring would be supposed to know where the flowers come from, but the truth of the matter is he doesn't. And so in the same way, if you ask the Lord God, how do you create the universe? He said, I have no special method. And this is known in Zen as a very difficult, this is the most difficult virtue to attain. So many of these things begin with mu. Buji. Buji. It means nothing special. It means no business, no artificiality. In American current, real cool. So, buji is where something doesn't stand out like a sore thumb. But it is absolutely different from being modest. A buji person may be immodest in the sense that if he knows he can do something well, he just says he can. He doesn't go at all sorts of blushing violet techniques. Buji, you see, is this mysterious quality of nothing special, no special method. Because if there is, let me repeat, if we do know the method and we know it infallibly, it ceases to be interesting. There are no surprises left. And the moment the element of surprise is gone, the zest of life is gone. That, you see, is why it's very difficult to teach Zen to yourself. Because you can't easily surprise yourself. The essence, you see, of this kind of spontaneity is response to a surprise. So the master, you don't know what he's going to do, and he surprises you. It's like trying to cure hiccups. Very difficult to cure yourself, because when you pat yourself on the back, you know when you're going to do it. So you're all ready for it. When somebody else comes up and slams you on the back, then that's a surprise, and what you needed was a surprise. Or it's like jokes. What makes you laugh about a joke is the element of surprise in it. That's why jokes aren't funny after they've been explained. So in the same way, all these Zen stories, if explained, have no effect. They're intended to produce what I would call metaphysical laughter. But this has to be a surprise. And so as to be surprised, well, there's no way of premeditating it. So you see, if you read, for example, there's a book out here called Zen by Eugen Herigel, who studied archery. Many of you have probably read this book. He had to learn to pull the bowstring in the manner of the Japanese archer and let it go, but not on purpose. He had to let it go without thinking first, I'll let it go, and then let go. He had to let it go, not on purpose. Now, that really bugged Herigel. How do you do something not on purpose? Especially if you're aiming at a target. Well, the whole point is, if you think before you shoot, it's too late. The target's moved. That's why we have a thing like beginner's luck. You see, if you simply point at something like that, if your finger was a gun, I would probably have hit the light switch. And so you get a person who's naive about a gun, will pick a gun up and bang, and the thing will drop dead. I'll never forget the first time I ever used a slingshot. This friend of mine was with me, and he was aiming away and not missing, and I just picked it up, and ping, and it hit. But I couldn't do it again. you get a certain naturalness there. So, there was a master by the name of Ikkyu, who was a great leg puller. And he had in front of his house a very gnarled pine tree. One of those things that's contorted, and they love this kind of thing. And he put a notice up by it. It said, I, Ikkyu, will pay 100 yen, which was a fair amount of money in those days, to anyone who can see this tree straight. Well, soon, there was a whole crowd of people around that tree, lying on the ground and twisting their necks and looking at it from all sorts of angles. And there was absolutely no way of seeing the tree with a straight trunk. But Ikkyu had a friend who was a priest of another sect, and a smart boy went over to see this friend and said, what about this Mr. Ikkyu's tree? Oh, said the other priest, it's perfectly simple. He said, you go and tell him the answer to seeing the tree straight is to look straight at it. So this man went over to Ikkyu and said, I claim the reward. He said, you look straight at it. And Ikkyu looked him in a funny way and said, he forked out the 100 yen and gave it to him. He said, I think you've been talking to Rosen down the street. Now, in that way, you see, just look straight at it. In other words, here's the bowstring, let go of it. Don't all this fimble-fambling, mimble-mambling, jumble-humble about the right technique of letting go of it. Let go of it, damn it! But that's very difficult. It's as if I would say to you, now everybody, let's be unselfconscious. And so finally, in desperation,